Today is Thursday, August 17th. We're going to be working on the hypothalamus and pituitary gland today. All right, so page 6 starts the hypothalamus and pituitary relationship. Yeah, you want the whole thing off or this one?
This one.
Okay. Damn, you can't have seen it. Yeah. Y'all just remind me if I forget to turn them off. Plus, it'll be cooler in here. So, when you learned about the hypothalamus back in 210, you probably learned it's a home for homeostasis. It is a place where hunger and thirst are regulated. And you probably recall having learned that it controls the endocrine system. And that's about all we say about hypothalamus in Bio-210. Here in Bio-211, we learn that the hypothalamus plays a really important role in controlling the endocrine system, and it does so by communicating with hormones to the pituitary gland. So just to kind of give you the layout here, we have studied the hypothalamus location in 210, and it sits in this region right here. There is an infundibulum stalk that connects your hypothalamus to the pituitary. The pituitary sitting down below actually has two portions. There's an anterior portion and a posterior portion. Do you know the difference between the two besides one being in the front and one being in the backside?
The anterior portion doesn't make its own hormones. It gets it from hypothalamus.
Okay, so posterior, yeah.
Posterior
doesn't make any hormones of its own. It gets them from the hypothalamus. And what about the anterior pituitary?
It kind of just stores them, right?
Makes its own. Good. So the difference is the anterior pituitary is endocrine gland tissue. Endocrine gland tissue is epithelial tissue. And the catch is the anterior pituitary makes hormones under the direction of the hypothalamus. Okay. So the endocrine tissue capable of making its own hormones.
And that's anterior.
That's anterior, yeah. Posterior pituitary is nervous tissue. It does not make its own hormones. It receives them from the hypothalamus. So to repeat, we've got two portions of the pituitary gland, an anterior portion and a posterior portion. The anterior portion is made up of endocrine gland tissue. That means it's made up of epithelial tissue. The posterior portion is made up of nervous tissue. Nervous tissue can't make hormones, so the posterior pituitary actually gets hormones from the hypothalamus. So back in 210, when you studied bones, you might recall learning a little piece of the sphenoid bone called the cella turcica, and that's considered to be a saddle. And in fact, the pituitary gland sits in that saddle of the cella turcica, and that's kind of the cradle that it's nested in. So kind of interesting that we can kind of start putting these pieces together. Now, if your pituitary gland starts to hypertrophy or enlarge, which portion do you think is the problem? The anterior or the posterior?
Anterior.
Why do you think it's the part that's growing and enlarging?
It makes its own hormones,
yeah. And it's made of epithelial tissue, and you may recall that epithelial tissue does grow quickly and repair itself quickly. So in fact, if the pituitary does enlarge, it's going to be that anterior portion that does a lot of the growing. The reason I make this point is because right here sitting nearby is the optic chiasma. If the anterior portion grows and enlarges, it can push on the optic chiasma. What information is being carried along those optic tracts and passing through that chiasma?
Sight vision, yeah.
So people may not experience vision issues, so to speak, but they may feel pressure or they may feel something pushing behind their eyes. And so that may be one of the warning signs for having a enlarged pituitary gland. But yeah, it's the anterior portion that would do the growth, the excess growth, since it's made up of epithelial tissue.
I feel like that would be an essay question in the test.
No, it's not. No. It's just trivia. Okay. So first thing here on the top of your page, it talks about the hypothalamus, and there's a mention of releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones. Let me pull your attention there. Releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones. Okay, so you know, some stuff is like really important, like in your face important, like don't miss this kind of important. That's what this is. So releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones are made by your hypothalamus. And it is their job to target and talk to the anterior pituitary. This makes a great flashcard if you have trouble keeping it straight. You may notice we abbreviate releasing hormones as RH, and we call the inhibiting hormones IH for short. You know, that's helpful to know. I'm not going to require you to memorize the abbreviations for all the hormone names. You've got enough to learn here in terms of hormone functions. So when I put this stuff on the test, I'll write out the entire hormone name, and then in parentheses I'll have some abbreviation like GHRH or GHIH. You know, if the abbreviations stick, that's great. But you know, don't feel like you have to go and say, gosh, I got all this extra stuff now I've got to memorize. Okay? So what would you rather learn? This phrase or this slide? No question, right? Okay, I'd rather learn this phrase. Because what this tells me is if you're a releasing hormone or an inhibiting hormone, you come from the hypothalamus, and you tell the pituitary, specifically the anterior portion, what to make or what not to make, okay? And so when you look at the list here, every one of these hormones made by the hypothalamus is classified as a releasing hormone or as an inhibiting hormone. And so all you've got to do is say, okay, the name in the front here is going to tell me what we're working with. So let me give you some examples. Let's take prolactin-releasing hormone down near the bottom of the list. Prolactin-releasing hormone is made by your hypothalamus, and it tells your anterior pituitary to make, guess what?
Prolactin.
Yeah. So instead of memorizing the list, you can simply just translate what this means. Prolactin-releasing hormone tells the anterior pituitary to release prolactin. Let's do another one. Let's take thyroid-releasing hormone. You've got to be careful here, though, because your anterior pituitary does not release thyroid hormones. Where are thyroid hormones released?
In the thyroid gland.
In the thyroid gland, yeah. So this is that type of hormonal pass-the-buck system we talked about at the very end of class on Tuesday. Your hypothalamus makes thyroid-releasing hormone. It tells your anterior pituitary to release thyroid.
Stimulating.
You got it. Stimulating hormone. Good. And then TSH goes to your thyroid gland and says, hey, thyroid gland, now you make
thyroid
hormones. Yeah. Great case of hormonal stimulation. It's one gland telling another gland what hormone to release. So we kind of get the sense that releasing hormones tell your anterior pituitary to release something. That makes good sense. So what does an inhibiting hormone from the hypothalamus tell the pituitary?
Stop making it,
yeah. So pretty straightforward setup here, the relationship between the hypothalamus and the anterior pituitary. Okay, I'm gonna cut the lights on for just a moment. And I'm just gonna keep a map here on the board so we can keep straight of this stuff. Let's just take this list from the top and work it down. We know that hypothalamus makes releasing and inhibiting hormones. We know that, you know, we've got GHRH, GHIH, starting at the very top of the list, and they would fall into that category. So in turn, when we make, say, growth hormone releasing hormone by the hypothalamus, the anterior pituitary in turn will make growth hormone. Okay? There's a pattern here. It may not be apparent right off at the onset, but we're going to find that pattern. So what does GHRH tell the anterior pituitary to do about growth hormone release? Increase it? Decrease it?
Increase it.
Good. What does growth hormone inhibiting hormone tell your anterior pituitary?
Stop it.
Yes. So it's kind of like a brake pedal and a gas pedal. It's either make it or stop making it. Okay? So we've got TRH next, that comes from the hypothalamus. It tells your anterior pituitary to release TSH. Good. All right, and so TSH, we'll talk about in just a moment, is thyroid stimulating hormone, and that tells your thyroid gland to make thyroid hormones. And if you want to continue to map on down, we'll just add this to it. Okay, and TH just stands generically for thyroid hormones. That's thyroxine and triiodothyronine. Say what? Okay, so T3 and T4, you may have heard of those before. Those are thyroid hormones. We'll get to those a little later. What if I want to stop making TSH? What should we have our hypothalamus tell the anterior pituitary? TIH, yeah. So if we need it, then there's a TIH. We're not going to cover every releasing and every inhibiting hormone. We're just going to hit the important ones here. The next one is called, whoa, that's a mouthful, corticotropic releasing hormone, or CRH for short. And that happens to come to your anterior pituitary and tell it to release a hormone called ACTH. Let me give you the built-in clue. Cortico stands for the cortex of the adrenal glands. Okay? Cortico stands for the cortex of the adrenal glands. AC means adrenal cortex.
You just answered a question I was going to ask you later
about these abbreviations.
I was going to ask, it was like, where did ACTH come from? Because I don't see that.
Yep. All right, so we'll just say that is going to tell the adrenal cortex gland to make hormones. And this is getting a little bit ahead here, but anybody happen to know what hormones are made by your adrenal cortex?
Cortisol.
Good. Another one?
A big mouthful.
Yeah, mineral corticoids, glucocorticoids, but aldosterone.
Aldosterone.
Yeah, that's one.
Say it again. I need to know how to say it.
Aldosterone, yeah, and its buddy is cortisol. Do you see the pattern?
Mm-hmm.
Not yet? Okay, so releasing hormones and inhibiting hormones are made where? And they target the
anterior pituitary.
Good. Which one of those two, releasing or inhibiting, tells your anterior pituitary to increase production?
Releasing.
Good. And shut it down?
Inhibiting.
Good. So this level here, the anterior pituitary, is controlled by the releasing and inhibiting hormones. So each one of these names here is linked to a hormone that the anterior pituitary could potentially make. Let's take our next one. Gonadotropic releasing hormone is going to be made by your hypothalamus. It targets the
anterior
pituitary, and it tells the anterior pituitary to make sex hormones that are called LH and FSH. Good. All right. And you know where these go?
Gonads,
yeah, because gonadotropics, that's the clue there, right? We're ultimately going to tell the gonads what to make. All So if I want to tell the ovaries to stop making estrogen, where do I have to start?
Hypothalamus,
yeah. And the hypothalamus will put out a hormone not called GnRH, but what would you name it?
GnRH.
I name it GnRH too. And that comes for the anterior pituitary. And what does it tell the anterior pituitary to do?
Stop releasing,
yes. So no more FSH, no more LH. And that doesn't get a message going to the gonads, ovaries or testes, to make the estrogen. So, you know, the old joke is sex starts in the brain. Actually, it does. It starts with your hypothalamus. So for women to make eggs, for women to make, you know, estrogen, for men to make sperm, and for men to make testosterone, that all has to start with the hypothalamus and that gonadotropic releasing hormone. So no wonder all these sex hormones are so complicated. Let's see, our last one there is prolactin-releasing hormone and prolactin-inhibiting hormone. Which one of those two tells your anterior pituitary to make prolactin? The releasing hormone, good. Since I'm almost out of room in that direction, what does prolactin tell your mammary glands to do?
Make milk.
Make milk, good. So prolactin targets mammary glands. Of course, that tells your mammary glands to secrete milk. You see the pattern yet? So what is the pattern from the hypothalamus to the pituitary? Yeah. Hypothalamus tells your pituitary either, hey, increase your production or decrease. Yeah, so releasing hormones increase production, inhibiting hormones decrease production. Let me add something there for growth hormones since we've got nothing written on the board for that one. What does growth hormone tell your cells to do? Grow. Yep, so we'll just add that up there. Okay, so we see a lot of growth in muscles and bones since they're the ones that elongate and make our bodies grow bigger when we're kids.
What is the TSH release? What gland is it? Okay.
Yeah. And I wouldn't put it all out there. I would, like you said, I'd pinpoint targeting pieces of it. Yeah. Okay, I'll hit lights again. So let's go back to the beginning. We know the hypothalamus controls the pituitary. The anterior pituitary is made up of endocrine tissue. Endocrine tissue is actually epithelial tissue. So the hypothalamus tells the endocrine tissue of the anterior pituitary what to make or what not to make. So what types of hormones travel through the blood system from the hypothalamus to the pituitary to encourage production?
The releasing hormones,
good. And if of course you want to shut down production, you send you've got it, inhibiting hormones, good. Okay. So what we've got over on page 7 is basically this flow path. I gave you every one of these anterior pituitary hormones and how they're released in response to releasing hormones coming from your hypothalamus. I'm going to work you through those in just a moment. All right, so let's take growth hormone first. All right, so think carefully here. Where is growth hormone made?
The anterior pituitary.
Anterior pituitary, good. What hormone from the hypothalamus tells your anterior pituitary to make growth hormone?
GHRH.
Good. Okay. So if your body's growing, you want the GHRH present to tell your anterior pituitary to make growth hormone. And of course, growth hormone is active pretty much with every single cell. If I tell you that growth hormone is a protein-based hormone, it's a protein-based hormone. Can you tell me what kind of mechanism we use to arouse our target cells?
Secondary messenger.
Secondary messenger, good. So in fact, all six of these anterior pituitary hormones are proteins. That means all six of them use a secondary messenger system. By the way, secondary messenger system, where is the receptor located?
Outside.
Yeah. On that plasma membrane, good. So every cell in your body, for the most part, has receptors for growth hormone. There's certain cells, like parts of your nervous system, that do not have receptors for growth hormone. But what this tells us is almost every cell in your body can respond to directions to grow. Interesting that we see predominant effects in our muscles, our bones, and our liver. So our liver can regenerate thanks to growth hormone receptors sitting in the plasma membrane. Interesting to note that levels of growth hormone tend to increase when we sleep. This is when our body repairs damaged tissues, and that's also why we want our kids to go to bed at night. Go to bed, let your body grow. So imagine if a child has interrupted sleep or perhaps an odd sleep cycle, how that could interrupt their growth patterns. Also, think about that for those of us who are older than age 18. If you're older than 18 and you work a night shift and sometimes you work a day shift and then now you're back to another shift, you're interrupting your sleep cycle. What impact does that have on your growth and your repair?
Slows it down,
yeah. So something to think about if you're really tired working that swing shift or night shift, maybe it has something to do with your ability to repair those damaged tissues and not enough growth hormone. All right, so this is what's laid out for you on the top of page, 7?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so there's kind of an instant flashcard you can clip and use. Growth hormone releasing hormone comes from your hypothalamus. It turns on growth hormone from your anterior pituitary, and in turn, that tells your body cells to grow larger in size. I do want to mention this, kind of to give you the big picture. Back when you guys studied mitosis in 210 lab, you may have learned about all the parts of interphase that lead up to mitosis. During interphase, there's two G periods. Sometimes they're called growth periods, other times they're called gap periods, but there's no mistake about what's happening during the G periods. It is growth hormone that's telling those cells to enlarge in size. So when those cells emerge from telophase of mitosis and they start getting bigger, that's growth hormone targeting that cell. I want to spend a few moments talking with you about some growth hormone problems. You may have heard of these before. They have to do with excess growth hormone or not enough growth hormone. Do you know what the word hypersecretion means?
Excessive.
Yeah, too much, excessive. What is the opposite of that?
Hypo.
Hypo, good. Which of these growth hormone disorders are considered to be a hypersecretion issue? Gigantism and acromegaly. Good. Which one of those two disorders affects kids during their growing years?
Gigantism.
Good. And of course, acromegaly there, it says affects adults. So let's take a look at the difference between those two. What we have to appreciate is what you guys learned back in 210. I know you're going to hear me say this like 30 times a class period, right? Back in 210. So what do you know about long bone growth? How do they grow longer? Epiphyseal plate, good. Around what age does the epiphyseal plate transition to a line?
Around
18. So if you're older than 18, do you think gigantism is a possibility for you?
Mm-hmm.
What problem is more likely the case?
Acromegaly,
right.
Appositional growth.
Or appositional growth, exactly, good. So gigantism can push heights upward of 7 feet, 8 feet, 9 feet. Throughout recorded history, there have been cases of people that have been 11, 12, even 14 feet in height. I can't imagine somebody being 14 feet, but you know, there's been cases accounted through history of that. You know, we think of a giant, and we think of somebody like Andre the Giant, who, you know, wrestler, really strong. But in fact, giants have real problems with their bones and their joints. What do you think happens to their joints as they grow bigger and taller?
They get weaker.
They get weaker, exactly. So unfortunately, people with gigantism have joint issues. Their rib cage is not built for the body size, so they're unable to breathe. And that puts a lot of stress on the heart and the cardiovascular system. Andre the Giant actually died with a heart attack, with heart issues, so that's not a surprise considering what this condition does to the human body. So he has both gigantism, or he had gigantism, and acromegaly. So after his epiphyseal plates transitioned to lines around age 18 to 21, what continued to happen to him? Appositional growth, right. So is appositional growth lengthening the bones or widening the bones?
Widening,
yeah. So you notice that his facial features, you can't really see his hands there, but we tend to see it in places where there's not a lot of tissue covering the bones. You know, there's not a lot of flesh around our facial bones, so if they widen, you can really see the change there. I don't know if my humerus bone gets wider. There's a lot of tissue around that bone, but not a lot of tissue around your hands and your feet. So if they become wider, then you're going to really notice the change because it's going to be quite visible. This woman was 7'8", if I'm not mistaken, at her death in 2002. I believe she was in her early 50s, and again, it's joint degradation, it's cardiovascular stress from having such a large body. A lot of these people cap out somewhere in the 400 to 500 pound range. And that's a lot of weight and a lot of pressure for the joints to handle and the cardiovascular system to handle. Yao Ming had gigantism, but not acromegaly. He just happened to be extremely tall for, you know, excess growth hormone. So he quit and retired from basketball due to, guess what? Joint issues, this man is the tallest one in recent recorded history. You know, we haven't been keeping a lot of records too far back, but since the mid-1800s when we started doing like Guinness Book of World Records, this man is capped out as our tallest. At 8'11" and age 21, he was still growing. What have most people done by the time they're age 21? What have they passed through? Puberty. Yeah, and what does puberty do to your growth plates? Use them, yeah. So no more lengthwise growth, right? But at age 21, he had not yet traveled through puberty, so that means that because he didn't have any testosterone or enough testosterone, that his bones were going to continue to lengthen through endochondral ossification. So back in this time period, he was touring with the circus, and he had a leg brace that rubbed a blister. Unfortunately, the blister got infected. He was in the hospital for 2 weeks and died from an infection. So he was like 22 years old at the time that he passed away. They called him the Alton, Illinois Giant. They buried him in a huge concrete vault so no one would dig his skeleton up and you know, use him as a touring show. And very interesting case. Nowadays, I think we probably could have treated him far before he got to the case of being 8'11". We know nowadays that testosterone and sex hormones hasten the closing of those epiphyseal plates. By the way, that's his dad next to him.
It must have been hard to get him shoes.
Yeah, he had custom shoes.
Yep.
And if you go to Myrtle Beach down there at Maine, at the pavilion, there is a wax statue of this guy, and the Ripley's Believe It or Not. You don't have to pay to go in to see it. If you just walk up to their street side ticket booth, then this huge statue is in there of this guy. So pretty incredible. So this is acromegaly. You know, the hands just enlarged, feet enlarged, facial features enlarged. That's due to excess growth hormone after the age of 18 to 21. You know, somebody may not realize they've got it until later in life. You'll notice this man earlier, and then notice how his facial features have dramatically changed. Another acromegaly case. Notice the brow ridge, notice the nasal bone, Notice the jawbone. Those are all things that tend to grow larger as we see excess growth hormone. This poor lady had it too. You'll notice she changed dramatically throughout her lifetime. Nowadays we can stop the growth hormone, but we can't reverse what's happened to your bones. So unfortunately in this time period either, even if they had been able to stop the growth hormone production, she would have still been faced with having these excessive growth of her hands and face and feet. So if you were going to, tasked with stopping acromegaly in its tracks, what would you manipulate? What would you stop?
Hypothalamus.
So what would you do to the hypothalamus? Tell the hypothalamus to release inhibiting hormone. And so what would that tell your anterior pituitary to do?
Stop
making growth hormone, exactly. Okay. On the far end of the spectrum, we've got pituitary dwarfism. And pituitary dwarfism technically caps out height below 4'7". 4'7" is kind of the cutoff, you might say, for dwarfism. And I should mention that there's over 100 different forms of dwarfism. The one we're talking about, though, called pituitary dwarfism, is specifically because of the deficiency of growth hormone. All right, so when do you think this primarily affects the body?
During childhood,
right. Do you think someone who is 35 years old can now experience pituitary dwarfism?
No,
it's not going to happen to you, right? So after you've passed through your childhood years and had an opportunity to grow, then, there's no opportunity to shrink back at that point. This picture shows several different types of people with dwarfism. We're going to look at these two here. These look like children mixed in with other types of dwarfism. The two with pituitary dwarfism have normally proportioned bodies. Their arms and legs are in proportion with their torso. Notice the one on the far left, and these two especially have a much more elongated torso than the other ones. So these two have what's called a chondroplasia. That is what the people have on Little People, Big World on the TLC channel. Okay, so the case of having too little growth hormone basically causes the body to grow at a much more slower rate. So how would you treat that? Let's say a five-year-old came into your office. How would you treat a five-year-old who has pituitary dwarfism?
Increase their
growth hormone. Right. When would you stop treating them with growth hormone?
Puberty.
Puberty, right. Because if you continue treating them past puberty, what risk do you run?
Acromegaly.
Yep, so most likely you would end up having the plates fuse and the bones grow wider. Yep. All right. Just a pause to jog our memories. Hormones that work together are called what?
Synergists.
Good. Hormones that work together are synergists. Another thing to jog our memory, if you have hormones working against each other, regulating blood calcium levels, what are they?
Antagonists.
They're antagonists. Good. Okay. How you doing with growth hormone? Any questions so far? All right. Looks like our next one is thyroxine. This is a great example of hormonal stimulation. In order to make your thyroid gland release thyroxine, which is a type of thyroid hormone, we have to start in your brain with what?
TRH.
Where is TRH made specifically?
Hypothalamus.
Good. TRH stands for thyroid releasing hormone. It tells your anterior pituitary to release
Thyroid stimulating hormone.
Good. We're going to find that a lot of these stimulating hormones do come from your anterior pituitary. That is to keep us straight from those releasing and inhibiting hormones that come from where?
The
hypothalamus. Good. So TSH The stimulating hormone travels from your anterior pituitary to your thyroid gland. How does it get there?
Bloodstream.
Good. All hormones travel the bloodstream, so TSH travels the bloodstream to your thyroid gland, and your thyroid gland now makes and releases thyroxine. All right, so most hormones work by a negative feedback loop. If you don't have enough thyroxine to maintain a normal basal metabolic rate, or BMR, this feedback loop gives information to your hypothalamus. Because your BMR is running slow, what does your hypothalamus now do?
Release
more TRH, and we come to your anterior pituitary telling it to do what? More TSH, yeah. And then an increased TSH now comes back to your thyroid gland telling it to make more thyroxine, yeah. So until we get your BMR where we need it to be, this negative feedback loop will constantly tell your hypothalamus to make more TRH, which tells your anterior pituitary to make more TSH.
It sounds more like the positive, right? Just like, that's kind of tricky.
Let's think of it this way. Okay. If you get it into a normal range, that inhibits and shuts off the loop. But yeah, it sounds like it's a positive feedback at first, but
because it's producing more
until it gets back to that normal range, yeah. We'll think of it another way. If it's too high, mm-hmm. it's also going to feedback a shut off for that system, yeah. So TSH, of course, is a stimulating hormone. Where is it made?
Anterior
pituitary, good. And what hormone from the hypothalamus will encourage your anterior pituitary to make TSH?
TRH,
good. Okay. Let's see, our next one here is ACTH. Keep in mind that AC stands for?
Adrenal cortex.
Good, adrenal cortex. So the adrenal glands sit on top of the?
Kidney.
Kidneys, good. All right, so this is a mouthful of words here. CRH stands for corticotropic releasing hormone. Where are all releasing hormones made?
Hypothalamus.
Good. That tells the anterior pituitary to make ACTH. That is a stimulating or a tropic hormone. That's where most of our tropic hormones come from. In turn, ACTH travels to the adrenal glands, and the adrenal glands make and release hormones like cortisol and aldosterone. So you've probably heard that stress can make you gain weight, and you've probably heard that stress can make you have high blood pressure. This is the mechanism. So if you happen to be stressed out, stress put stress on your hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus says, oh, we must be being chased. We must be under stress, whether it's psychological or physical stress. You can increase levels of CRH, ACTH, and in turn increase levels of aldosterone and cortisol. We're going to learn about those probably on Tuesday. Those two hormones regulate weight gain, weight loss, and blood pressure. So we'll talk more about this stress feedback mechanism on Tuesday. Let's see, we've done this one already. GnRH stands for gonadotropic releasing hormone. Keep that GN straight because it's a reminder that we're talking about the gonads. What does GnRH target?
Anterior pituitary.
Anterior pituitary, good. In response, what does your anterior pituitary make and release?
FSH and LH.
Good, FSH and LH, good. FSH stands for follicle-stimulating hormone. LH stands for luteinizing hormone. We will actually cover these again when we talk about reproduction at the very end of this course. At any rate, FSH and LH tell the gonads, ovaries for females, testes for males, to make either sex hormones like estrogen or testosterone, or to make egg and sperm. So if you interrupt any part of this cycle, you can see how a male may experience sterility, a female may experience wild swings in her menstrual ovarian cycle. So this cycle has to be regulated in order for us to see sex cell production and hormone production. Is your brain full yet? Long ago. I promise you this is the worst of the endocrine. Once we get past this, we're good. We're on smooth sailing after this stuff. Okay, so PRH stands for prolactin-releasing hormone. It is made where?
Here?
No. Oh, no.
Hypothalamus, good. It targets the anterior pituitary, which in turn releases prolactin. Yeah, we call it PRL for short. All right, so prolactin tells the mammary glands to produce milk. Something to think about. The releasing hormone is not always the one in control. Unless you're currently producing milk and breastfeeding, PRH is not in control of you right now. What instead is in control? PIH, yeah, the inhibiting hormone. So for those who are not currently breastfeeding or producing milk or lactating, then PIH is the hormone in control. And it tells the anterior pituitary not to release. Yeah, shut off the prolactin, don't release it. And so there is no message sent to the breast tissue to make and release milk. Okay, so got a question there for you on the very bottom of page 7. If you're in that block there for prolactin, what role does PIH play? Good. It inhibits the release of prolactin.
You said it's in control when it's not producing?
Yeah, PIH is in control when you're not producing. So the only people that should see PRH in control are breastfeeding moms. You know, anyone else who's not currently breastfeeding or lactating for that purpose should not have breast milk production. This is part of my public service announcement for the day. If you know a female or a male who is lactating or producing any kind of secretion from their breast, you know, and they're not feeding babies, that is a warning sign for some problem going on in the breast tissue or some problem with this mechanism here. All right.
Question.
Sure.
Does milk develop only when you're pregnant and the prolactin is released, or is it just stored there and then the inhibiting part of it makes it not able to release, but it's still there, and
okay,
then the prolactin comes, that's when the milk comes out? Is that how that happens?
It's not there.
Okay.
So, no one is carrying breast milk unless they're pregnant or lactating or nursing babies.
Okay.
And only at that time, that mechanism flips on, and then we start making milk, basically.
To start with, you make colostrum, and then you make breast milk. So
right.
You're still not really producing milk, you're producing colostrum.
Which is like fat.
Yeah.
But some medications give the action.
Right.
You're not even pregnant.
Right. Which is good to be aware of if you're taking that medication. Yep. Good questions. How about others? All right, so got a quick review here for you. What is the target organ of thyroid-stimulating hormone?
Thyroid
gland. Good. And the function of TSH is?
Stimulate the thyroid.
Stimulate the thyroid, good. And what hormone, back it up a step, tells the anterior pituitary to release TSH?
TRH.
TRH, good. And by the way, where does TRH come from?
Hypothalamus,
good. All right, so then we've got the target organ of ACTH.
Adrenal glands,
good. And the function of ACTH?
To activate the adrenal glands to secrete the aldosterone.
Yeah, and cortisol, good. And then back it up a step. You got right. What ultimately tells your anterior pituitary to release ACTH?
CRH.
CRH, good. Okay, and the target organ of prolactin?
Mammary gland.
Mammary glands, good. The target organ of prolactin inhibiting hormone?
Still mammary
gland.
Pituitary.
Pituitary, yeah. All our releasing inhibiting hormones are made by the hypothalamus, all target the pituitary. And a person who is in a basically a non-lactating human, which hormone is normally in control?
PIH.
Good. Shut off prolactin release if you're not lactating. There's no need for breast milk. But a female who is breastfeeding, now what controls prolactin?
PRH.
PRH. Good. Just a side note of trivia. I think this is kind of cool to know. Bananas contain dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter. You may have heard of that in a psych class before. And dopamine is actually PRH. And if you eat bananas, you know, people sometimes think that that has something to do with turning on prolactin-releasing hormone, but there's the blood-brain barrier, and dopamine in your bloodstream cannot cross the blood-brain barrier. So a lot of old wives' tales out there exist about certain things like that. But it's kind of cool to know the science behind it, that dopamine is PRH, and actually it's, bananas are rich in dopamine. Okay. Let's hit the posterior pituitary. I'm going to take you back to page 6 for just a moment. You've been through the worst. You've now been through hypothalamus and anterior pituitary. That is by far the most content we have to cover for endocrine. It gets better from here out. So you can breathe a sigh of relief when you go home to know that it's going to get better for the endocrine come Tuesday. The posterior pituitary is a little different. It is not endocrine tissue. It is made up of what type of tissue?
Nervous
tissue. Nervous tissue can't make and release its own hormones, so where does the posterior pituitary get the hormones from?
Hypothalamus.
Good. There are two hormones made by your hypothalamus and that are stored in axon terminals found in your posterior pituitary. Take a look at this long strand here. It looks like a big yellow strand. This is the cell body of a neuron. These are the axons. And down below, the axon terminals are actually sitting on a blood portal system. So when your hypothalamus says go, your posterior pituitary then releases hormones directly into the bloodstream. Now, these are going to be neurally stimulated because the hypothalamus is actually part of the nervous system. And this is a nervous system connection to the posterior pituitary. So part of the control mechanism here is a neural control mechanism.
That was one of the questions I put, like which part is part of the endocrine system, which is part of the nervous system.
And it would be that, yeah, sure is. So let's take the oxytocin hormone first. This one is made by your hypothalamus and stored in your posterior pituitary. The hypothalamus tells the posterior pituitary when to release oxytocin. Something you should look out for, there are no hormones released by your, or made by your posterior pituitary. Its only job is to release these two hormones, oxytocin and antidiuretic hormone. So what is the target organ of oxytocin?
Uterus,
good. So for a pregnant female who is about to undergo labor and give birth to a baby, what does oxytocin tell the uterus to do?
Contract.
Good. When the uterus contracts, a feedback mechanism that is positive in nature feeds back to the hypothalamus. Of course, if the contraction was successful, we want to increase and produce more oxytocin. So the hypothalamus tells the posterior pituitary to do what?
Release more.
So now more oxytocin comes to the uterus. and this time the contraction should be stronger. We continue this feedback loop, which is positive in nature, between your uterus, if you're a female, and the hypothalamus. What is the goal here? Get the baby out, yeah. Have the contractions be strong enough to push the baby out. You know, any woman who's ever given birth knows that you don't want the contractions to lessen. Speed them up, get this over with, right? Okay, so the stronger the contractions, the more oxytocin is released. The more oxytocin is released, the stronger the contractions should be. So this positive feedback mechanism is one of the few positive feedback loops in the human body. Interesting that the oxytocin hormone also plays a role of permission. It tells mammary glands that they now have permission for prolactin to do its job. All right, so if oxytocin is present and prolactin is present at the breast tissue, what can the mammary glands now do?
Make milk.
Make milk. What if prolactin is present at the mammary glands but not oxytocin?
It won't produce
milk. Yeah. So oxytocin is permissive. It tells the mammary glands it's okay to let prolactin turn on milk production. Every time a baby cries, what happens?
Milk
letdown. So every time a baby cries, this neural trigger comes back to the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus tells the posterior pituitary, release oxytocin. Oxytocin comes to the mammary glands and says, hey, prolactin, do your job now. Babies are crying, they must be ready to feed, right? So whether it's your baby or someone else's baby, all it takes is that neural stimulation to let oxytocin come out of the posterior pituitary.
Oxytocin,
that's all they are, oxytocin stimulators. And suckling from the nipple will also do it. So we call this permissive relationship a letdown reflex, and that's what oxytocin is present for. As long as it can release, you know, from the posterior pituitary, it turns on this reflex. Any known function for males? No. Well, if you gave a guy oxytocin and prolactin, guess what? He could breastfeed.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. All it takes is turning on that mechanism. Yeah. So, you know, it's unlikely that that's going to happen.
They need to get one and take one for the team. Yeah. Really devoted prophet.
They do. They do.
In infants, when there's male or female, isn't there enough that's crossed over from the mother that an infant can actually produce milk?
Yes. Yeah, until the hormones are kind of flushed out of that baby system, yeah, they may lactate themselves. Yeah. They can breastfeed themselves, right? There's something cool about this hormone I wanted to tell you. Oxytocin is also a neurotransmitter. And if you've ever met somebody and fallen head over heels in love, blame oxytocin. Because, you know, somebody may have said to you, oh, you're just blinded by love, you can't think straight, you may have heard this stuff before. That's oxytocin, because it is a love-bonding trust hormone, so it makes you feel like you are bound to this other person. It's also what makes mothers bind to their infants. You know, most women who go through labor, if they have a vaginal birth, they're not really interested in, let's get up and play with the baby. Yeah, you know,
that's why when other women have babies,
they want a baby.
All of a sudden, another woman wants a baby.
Exactly.
Well, that's what baby fever comes from.
Baby fever, oxytocin.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. Dangerous hormone.
Yeah.
I'm
like, give it a
scary.
It is scary. Completely switching gears to something that's not so fun is ADH. Okay, so we're going to hit this one again as we go throughout the course. It's going to be a very important hormone for us. And because it's such an important hormone, I really want to emphasize it right now. Antidiuretic hormone means against urine formation. So anti is against, diuretic is urine formation. Its alternate name is vasopressin. And it sounds bad, but it's actually very important for you. It makes you retain water. And I know what you're thinking. Boy, this is the bloating hormone, right? Actually, it's the one that prevents you from being dehydrated. It's a very important one to prevent dehydration. And by the way, a lot of this stuff is over on page 9. Wait a minute, that's page 8. Sorry. There's a box with some of this content on page 8. So I'll give you a little sneak preview of our next chapter. We're going to be talking about blood pressure eventually. And blood pressure is primarily dependent on how much fluid you have circulating in your bloodstream. That's why if you retain water, thanks to antidiuretic hormone, that you end up having blood pressure increase. Also, this happens to be a hormone that squeezes your vessels, and that's why we call it vasopressin. It performs a job called vasoconstriction. That means you take your blood vessels and you tighten them and squeeze them. That also helps to increase blood pressure. So you ever sit down and eat some salty potato chips or some peanuts or anything that's salty and not have enough to drink with it, and then an hour or so later you're like, oh gosh, I'm about to, you know, just want to turn up a whole gallon of water and drink it? That is actually ADH at work. If you've ever had a salty meal and your bloodstream becomes extremely salty, we now have what's called high osmotic pressure. Don't worry about that word, we'll hit it later. But the goal here is, if you are too salty, your body wants to retain water to help dilute down the saltiness of your bloodstream. So ADH is also a driver behind your thirst mechanism. It's going to want to make you drink to replenish your lost fluids. It also tells your kidneys to retain fluid and not urinate them out. So when you go to the bathroom and you pee a small amount of dark yellow urine, you know that ADH is in control of you right now, causing you to retain fluids.
Is that why when you first urinate in the morning, it's usually darker than throughout the rest of the day?
Probably because you have been drinking for some 8 or so hours, yeah. So very, very bottom question here. What does alcohol do to your body?
It suppresses
good. It dehydrates you. Alcohol suppresses antidiuretic hormone production and release. And if you don't have ADH, there goes water retention. You urinate out this water. You increase the chance for dehydration. And that explains a lot of the symptoms that come along with alcohol consumption. The headache the next day can come from the dehydration from the alcohol. The cottony dry mouth can also come from dehydration from the alcohol. So being cool and sip something along with your alcohol so that you stay hydrated, right?
Is that what they usually tell you, drink water or Gatorade?
Not something sugary because that'll further the dehydration, as will a caffeinated drink. Gatorade would be a very cool choice to have with your alcohol.
So is the, like, wipe up and drink a beer after a night of drinking to get rid of your anger?
Probably worst thing ever, right? Yeah, chase a beer with another, yeah. So, you've probably heard of diabetes before. This is actually a rare form of diabetes associated with ADH insufficiency. This one is called diabetes insipidus. And I keep the word insipidus kind of in my mind because this particular form is going to make you very, very thirsty. It has nothing to do with glucose or insulin problems. This particular form of diabetes is an ADH insufficiency, meaning your brain doesn't release enough ADH. What is polyuria? Good. Excessive urination. And how about polydipsia?
Excessive thirst.
Excessive thirst. Good. So notice there is no problem in this form of diabetes with sugar, with insulin. That is not even on the radar for this particular diabetes form. It is entirely lack of ADH, means you don't retain water. And then, of course, you're thirsty to replace the fluids you lose out. For a person with diabetes insipidus, how would you describe the person's urine output?
Frequent.
Frequent, yeah. Okay, so light-colored, dilute urine, constant urination, and then constantly thirsty to replace those lost fluids. So if this person went in for a checkup and said, you know, I drink all the time and I pee all the time, and they run a blood test and say, well, your blood glucose is okay, what now should they look at? What body parts should they look at?
Pituitary gland.
Pituitary gland, right. Why look at the pituitary? Yep, see if it's releasing ADH, good. Would looking at the kidneys really be the best place? Mm-hmm. Now, because this condition is the brain, right? It's pituitary and hypothalamus. All right, so that should wrap it up on page 8. Do y'all have questions? Anything I can clarify for you?
So is that why people with diabetes usually have, like, kidney problems or ketoacidosis?
If they're mellitus, the sugar-based one with insulin problems, that drives those issues. This person won't have either of those.
So are they still up on sugar then, or, like, what?
No sugar issues here. It's just basically you're a hose. Water comes in and water goes out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do we need to know which hormones does this kind of stimulus, like neural hormones or?
I'd probably look at that. There's some that we're going to hit that are really good examples coming up, and so I'll definitely emphasize that on the next pages or so.
Now, with somebody with diabetes insipidus, do they run a high risk of seeing the adrenaline block?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, either form of diabetes would put you in that risk category, yeah. Let me just introduce the thyroid, and then we'll call it a day. We've just got a tab there on the top of page 9 that I'll cover with you. I'd like to introduce you to two glands sitting around your neck. These two are the thyroid gland and the parathyroid glands, and they wrap around your trachea. We all have a piece of cartilage called the thyroid cartilage. In males, we call it an Adam's apple, but females have the thyroid cartilage too. If you find that thyroid cartilage that sticks out on your trachea and then go down just a little bit, this bow tie-shaped gland sitting around your trachea is called your thyroid gland. On the back side, if you were to pop off the thyroid and look at the back side of it, you would find somewhere between 4 and 8 little nodules of parathyroid gland tissue. So, very important set of glands here in the neck. Interesting to note that the thyroid is our largest purely endocrine gland. You know, its only function in the world is to secrete hormones. If you look at the thyroid gland in cross-section, you'll notice that there are these areas that look like lakes. These are storage areas for thyroid hormone. There's a jelly-like substance in there, and we call that jelly-like substance colloid. So a number of years ago, I was diagnosed with hypothyroidism. And, you know, basically it's a life sentence. Now you're going to take thyroid hormones for the rest of your life. And, you know, I got tired of taking them, and I went one time to the doctor's office, and I said, you know, I want to go off this thyroid medication. I don't know if I really need it or not. And, of course, the answer was, well, you would have to wait for 30 days to see how you would feel without your thyroid medication. Why 30 days? Flush it out of your system, right. you actually store thyroid and that colloid for 30 days. And then so after 30 days, your own system is going to have to kick up production and make your own. So, you know, I wasn't willing to risk feeling like death warmed over for 30 days. So here I am taking thyroid hormone.
I tried it.
Did you?
I felt like crap. And they were like, huh, guess who's going back on it.
Of course. You tried it too?
Do it all the time, but it don't work. You look back
on. Yeah, and I think it makes you probably feel worse if you're off and on. Yeah. So thyroid problems are actually a pretty common thing, especially among women. And yeah, you store it for 30 days there in that colloid in the thyroid gland. It's kind of like a jelly-like substance in there. Where we make thyroid hormone is in a set of cells called follicle cells. And if you look at this picture and pretend that you're looking at an aerial view of a bunch of lakes and beaches, the portion surrounding the colloid, kind of like the beach, that is the follicle cells. And those follicle cells are the ones that make the thyroid hormones that are then stored in this colloid for around 30 days. We make another hormone in your thyroid gland besides thyroid hormones. What is that second hormone? It's a calcium regulating hormone.
Oh, terrified.
Calcitonin.
Oh.
Calcitonin. Do you know where calcitonin is made? Yeah, you got a pair of follicle cells, and they are not the ones lining that colloid. These pair of follicle cells are in the background here. And we don't store calcitonin, it's made on demand. The only one we store here is thyroid hormones in that colloid. So let me make sure you got your blanks filled in there on the top of page 9. Follicle cells make thyroid hormone, and then parafollicle cells make calcitonin. So where we're headed is we're going to cover thyroid hormones on Tuesday. That's page 9. Parathyroids, page 10. We're going to cover adrenals from pages 12 and 13. And if we have time, we'll start on the pancreas. But we're getting close to finishing up this chapter on Tuesday. All right, y'all have a great weekend.